Hello. In this audio snippet, we intend to continue talking about the 15th Amendment and a little bit about Ulysses Grant's presidency. And hopefully we'll also try to explain a little more the connection, the subtle connection between what we're talking about here with Grant and the post-Civil War period. And what happened with Nancy, the whore Nancy Pelosi's husband, and the alleged incident with the fellow who allegedly attacked him with a hammer and all that. But before we talk about that, we'd like to talk about two separate stories that are somehow related to, as well, to all that we're talking about, believe it or not. One of them is a story, a headline that I saw recently about the Arizona State Senate race at the time of this recording. There's a race for that Senate seat in Arizona, and there were three candidates who were vying for that seat. One was the Democrat Mark Kelly. I believe he is the incumbent. I'm not too sure. But he was the favorite, the heavy favorite, to win that election that's coming up shortly. And besides him, there was this candidate called Blake Masters that is a Republican and very much liked by conservatives. And then there was a third candidate called Mark Victor, who is a libertarian. So there were these three candidates, and apparently Blake Masters, the Republican, who's liked by conservatives, has caught up and closed the gap with the Democrat favorite, Mark Kelly. And in one of the latest polls, Mark Kelly, the Democrat, had 45%. Blake Masters had 43%, and then the Libertarian, Mark Victor, had 6%. And the headline that I saw that caught my attention was that the Libertarian had decided to bow out of the race and threw his support for the Republican, Blake Masters. So in other words, he wanted to bow out of the race so that he would not split the vote, that the anti-Democrat vote, and then he officially supported Blake Masters. And the headline said, huge development, and you know, and it was, I was reading this on a conservative website, and it's like, oh, great news. And the story was written by Jim Hoff, the person that I've spoken about before. And it was all, you know, this celebratory explanation of what had happened, or description of what had happened. And as I read the story, I said, oh, well, nice that Mark Victor did that. But it angered me as I was reading it, because it again exposes how stupid conservatives can be. And again, it makes me think about the condition of the country. And it always seems to stir this sense of hopelessness that there are few signs of America waking up, and the reason why it angered me, not so much the story itself, but the writing of the story, was that this same person has also been very critical of ranked choice voting that we have talked about in previous audio snippets. And in ranked choice voting, you can have multiple choices. So you say that your number one vote is this person, and your second option is this person. And that system was blamed for the loss of Sarah Palin in a recent election, in a congressional election, a special election in Alaska that we talked about extensively, but we tried to explain that it really had nothing to do with the ranked choice voting system. It was, and it was not a, it had nothing to do really with Sarah Palin per se. It had to do with Alaska not being as red as people think it is. In other words, Alaska is a bit of a pathetic case as well, as much as the rest of the country. What angered me is that this same person who is so opposed to ranked choice voting is happy that the third party candidate bowed out of a race that is not being, it's not going to be using ranked choice voting. And that proved to me that this person is not cogent. And I know he must be a very intelligent person, and I've read some of his other articles, and I agree with a lot of the things he says, and he makes a lot of sense. But the problem is that he is blinded. It's like this idolatry that we've talked about, this disgusting idolatry that conservatives, American conservatives, have about the founding fathers and the Constitution, a repugnant idolatry. That blinds their understanding of things. And a person with common sense would say, well, this is exactly what ranked choice voting is intended to address. In a situation where you have more than two candidates, you need a ranked choice voting mechanism to prevent the splitting of votes. Because if we had ranked choice voting in this election, it wouldn't matter whether Mark Victor, the Libertarian, bowed out or not. Because people who supported Blake Masters would vote number one for Masters, and or people who supported Mark Victor would vote number one for Victor, and more than likely, especially considering that Mark Victor ended up endorsing Blake Masters, you would think from that Victor and Masters are not that different in many ways, or have a lot of similarities, and therefore the voters that support Victor would also lean more towards the Republican Masters than towards the Democrats. So more than likely, their second choice in a ranked choice voting system would be Masters, and that means that if that poll that we just mentioned was let's say the actual voting, if Mark Kelly got 45%, Masters got 43%, and Victor got 6%. Because Kelly didn't get an outright majority, then the votes for Mark Victor would end up going, let's say that 5% out of the 6% put in Masters as their second choice, and the other 1% put in Kelly, which would be unlikely, but let's just say that. Then the final results would be that Blake Masters would get 48%, 43 plus 5, and Mark Kelly get 45 plus 1, 46, and the Republican would win. So, but this Jim Hoft, like all the other conservative idolaters, doesn't realize that because under the current system, he depends on the goodwill of a third-party candidate to bow out if he is going to be splitting the vote, the conservative or whatever vote. But under a ranked choice voting system, it doesn't matter whether Mark Victor decides to bow out or not. And the problem also is that under the current system, a lot of third-party candidates who might not win but have something important to say, could eventually rise to a position of relevance through the exposure of being in an election, have to bow out because they're constantly having to think about how their presence affects or splits the votes and changes the dynamic of the election. And it shouldn't be like that. Everyone who is a valid candidate should be allowed to vote, and through the ranked choice voting system, we'd be able to weed out the people who don't have much possibilities of winning, and at the same time, allow more voices to be heard, and at the same time, prevent the problem of vote splitting, and we would also avoid the need for runoff elections, because the runoff election is being done automatically whilst you're voting in the first election, because you're saying, if my candidate does not win, I want this other guy to win. So it's the same thing as a runoff election, because under the current system, if you add the concept of a runoff election, then if no one is a clear winner, then the two highest vote getters go to the second round in the runoff, and all the other people who voted for the other candidates who did not make it to the runoff will vote for one of the two survivors, which is exactly what would happen in during the ranked choice voting. They're saying, hey, if my candidate doesn't make it, I want this other guy to win. It's the same thing, and it saves money, because there's no need to run a second election. And on top of that, you are motivating people to think about it straight away when they're there voting, because sometimes in runoff elections, people who voted once may not be that motivated to go and vote again. So then that kind of distorts the actual popularity or will of the people. So this story, it was just an example of conservative stupidity, and it relates to what we've been talking about with the 15th Amendment, because the 15th Amendment had to do with voting. As we said mentioned before, the 15th Amendment said that the right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. And it has to do with this problem we have in embedded in the Constitution left by the stupid founding fathers, who gave the states full authority or complete sovereignty over how to run their elections and what criteria to put to decide who can vote and who cannot vote. And because it was left up to the states, then we create this environment of ambiguity. And we need a system of that is consistent, that is very clear and simple and centralized, where the parameters are clearly centralized. And not only in terms of who can vote, but also the way that the voting is to be done. Instead of all this hodgepodge of different regulations in different states that create, as we have explained so many times ad nauseum, it creates the ability to do localized corruption, which is much more difficult to trace and to fight against than centralized corruption. Because the centralized corruption is much more visible, and then more people can see it and confront it, as opposed to this local stuff where it just gets drowned out in the local environment and so forth. We've talked about that before. So we need a system, and that's what the new American Constitution would bring, is a system where we define in the Constitution very clearly, these are the people who can vote. Very simple, very straightforward. No state can start adding any sort of law to twist things around, as happened with the 15th Amendment, and we talked about that briefly, the Jim Crow laws in the South that emerged because they tried to get around the 15th Amendment by adding all these extra little regulations that didn't really say, you know, black people can't vote, but were tantamount to disenfranchising black people. And it was because we didn't have a clear system where, okay, this is it, you can't add anything. So if you defined it in a very concise and clear way, then we can lay it out in such a way that there's clearly no room for discrimination or any sort corruption to be introduced. And so as we said, we have to have a system where the who can vote is very clearly defined with very simple and straightforward parameters, And the voting mechanism is also centralized with a very list of clearly well-defined parameters and with a process of verification. And that if an election is deemed under certain parameters to have been questionable, then it has to be repeated. No questions asked. I mean, we just if there's so much ambiguity and so forth, then we need to do a repeat. This is not something to talk about in detail in this audio snippet, but the requirements there would have to include concepts of verification, like double verification, which in most cases require some sort of physical ballot or something that is connected to your voting. So even if we use technology, digital technology, there has to be some sort of paper document that goes with your vote. So because in the digital world, things can get turned, upside down with the click of a mouse. A one becomes a zero, a zero becomes a one, and it happens in the virtual digital world, and no one can really trace it. And that's why we have to, at the end of the day, rely on a physical ballot. And that's something that happened in Brazil in a recent election around the time of this posting, where they stole the election from Jair Bolsonaro. There was this criminal, worthless son of a bitch who'll burn in hell soon, worthless little bastard boy called Lula or some moronic name. And he was in jail. He was released from jail because some judge in Brazil was, I'm sure, bribed into throwing out the charges because they were questionable. I'm not sure about the details, but the thing is, the guy was let out of prison and allowed to run for the presidency of Brazil. And he was well behind throughout most of the night of voting. And then suddenly, just like it happened here in the U.S., then he overtook Bolsonaro and ended up winning. And Jair Bolsonaro had requested that the system in Brazil had some sort of paper backing, and some judge there denied the motion for that, and that enabled the stealing of the vote. And I'm sure that the Brazilian worthless bastards who did this were inspired by what the sons of bitches, like Pelosi and Schumer and all these other people did here in the U.S. And Andy Coma, the former pseudo governor of New York, and all these people who worked together to put together the fraud. And so the Brazilians were inspired. So if we had done something about it, if we had had a different system, if we were not so blinded by the idolatry towards the founding fathers and all this, then we would have had a different system, or we would have had people who would have known how to fight this thing, and then the Brazilians would not have been as inclined to try to imitate what was done here. So it was a great loss in the way Trump, for example, stupidly fought like an idiot. How he contested the election in such a stupid way because he listened to the wrong people. He was listening to Giuliani instead of listening to other people who knew better. Because again, Trump had his ears were listening to the voices of Kushner and his little whore of a daughter, Ivanka, and they kept giving him advice on how to do things, and eventually he lost because he didn't know how to fight it, and now we have other countries being inspired by the fraud doing the same thing. But the thing is that we need a system that has verifiable parameters, which should include paper, some sort of paper backing of the electronic vote, so that if there's any questions, we can go to the paper ballot and count those, because those don't just virtually disappear unless somebody burns them, but or changes them. But it is a physical document or paper is much more difficult to manipulate and can be more easily verifiable. But the thing is, we need these parameters, and we have had this problem, and that would also include some sort of identification, because how is it that anyone can just show up and say, I'm so-and-so, and vote? It's ridiculous. We've had this trust system, like honor code type system, for way too long, and we've been having this problem for decades and decades. Decades. I mean, I've been hearing about dead people voting in Chicago since I was a kid. So it is surprising to me that people then now that it's coming back to bite them in the behind. Conservatives now complain about the fraud, and they don't when they should have been fighting it from a long time ago. But to fight it, you have to first admit the founding fathers got it wrong from the beginning, and we don't have a system that is correct, because it's relying on federalism, and federalism is a piece of excrement. That's exactly what it is. But if you're an idolater, if you worship these people, you stupid conservative idiot, then you will never see the truth, because you will be blinded by the excrement in your eyes. And that's the problem we have in this country. A lot of people blinded by conservative or founding father excrement. So we wanted to talk about that story about Mark Kelly and Blake Masterson and the ranked choice voting system, and how conservatives still don't get the whole thing. I mean, fraud has happened right in front of them, and they just see it as a one-time incident. It's like a person who just focuses on the symptoms all the time. And then one symptom happens here, they try to deal with it, and then because they don't deal with the root, then the symptom happens again later and later and later. And they tend to ignore the little symptoms. As we've said before, there's so many things that have been a problem from a long time ago and have gotten out of control. We've had the forcible health insurance for a long time. It's called Medicare, where people are forced to buy an insurance that they are not asking for. We are paying into it, and then at the end we get this very complicated and very distorted insurance at the end, here in America, and then we are stunned that suddenly we are forced to buy health insurance by the liberals, when the problem was there. And then the question goes, well, okay, we have a problem here. What is the underlying root of it? What is wrong with our system that is allowing this to happen? But to do that, you have to say the founding fathers were imperfect and they did a lot of things wrong. Not just imperfect, they were fundamentally flawed. And I hope that in a future audio snippet, if we ever get to it, we will talk about the philosophical problems that these people had. And the philosophical problems can be summarized in one person that they worshipped. So the founding fathers are worshipped by the conservatives. The founding fathers, in turn, worship certain ideologies, and there's one philosopher that embodies a lot of the things that they idolized, and that had a lot to do with why the Constitution is so poorly written and so fundamentally and metaphysically flawed. And we'll talk about that philosopher. If I mentioned his name, many of you would know exactly who I'm talking about. So it's not some sort of conspiracy theory, dark writer out there that I'm talking about. Somebody who's very well known and much beloved. Conservatives love him. The intellectual ones who know a lot about philosophy and history and all that stuff love the guy. But he's one of the most destructive forces in American history. And he wasn't even an American, ironically. But he's a lot to blame for a lot of the woes we have. But you know, at the end of the day, we are the ones to blame because it's not. It takes two to tango: one to say the lie, and the other one to believe it. And we have been collectively, as a people, believing a great bunch of lies, and we're still not waking up. Sadly, we're not waking up. And the other thing that I wanted to talk about, which is not as related to what we have discussed, but I believe is related in some distant way and is worth mentioning very quickly, is a story that's been happening at the time of this recording about a basketball player, a black basketball player, who plays, if I'm not mistaken, for the Brooklyn Nets here in the New York area. And his name is Kyrie Irving, and he has been banned at the time of this recording suspended for 5 games by the Brooklyn Nets because he said something controversial. And one of the things that he's been controversial about in the news is that he hasn't been a fan of the rape by injection. So he has voiced his concern about it, but when he voices his concern, it's always in this very kind of diplomatic way. It's not like he is the sort of person who has a lot of good ideas. I believe he has a certain connection to the truth, but he is trying to toe the line between abiding by certain principles of truth and at the same time placating the left. And liberals. So he's towing the line, but he has very poor balance because he seems to be stumbling over to the liberal side in the sense of appeasing them and playing to their emotionalism and all that. So he has convictions, but not enough to stand up and really fight the fight. And he said some things. I'm not too sure about the details, but it has something to do with him mentioning some film that had some anti-Semitic, supposedly, comments in it. I don't know the story. I don't know if it's really anti-Semitic, because nowadays, you know, if you say something a certain way, it's racist, even if it really isn't. So who knows if what was said in that film was anti-Semitic or not. But the thing is that he apparently liked some of the things that were said in that film, and mentioned it in a tweet somewhere, and people said, oh, he's a racist. And then he said, I apologize, this very profuse apology, saying, no, I'm not, I side with my Jewish brothers and sisters and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, all apologetic, instead of just being bold, say, hey, you know, I'm not an anti-Semite, and this, you know, have some backbone and just fight it with character and direct integrity. Instead, he's trying to kind of please everybody. And you never win with that, because liberals don't, if you are not bowing to the white liberal, and abiding by his ideologies and everything, every dictate that comes out of the white bastard liberal's mouth, then you are going to be thrown to the lions, no matter what. You have to comply fully. The white liberal, the fascist white liberal, demands full compliance to everything he says, and you cannot question it. Until people who disagree with them understand this, we're going to have all the time these people who just try to play both sides and try to get along and being apologetic and this and that, and it just does not work. This worthless company that no one should ever buy anything from them, Nike, worthless little company that has financed so much evil. This company has apparently they were going to release a line of shoes related to this Kyrie Irving. So if they were going to do that, I imagine he must be a very good basketball player. I haven't followed professional sports for years, unfortunately, because of all the all the liberal infiltration in every sport. So he must be a good player, but Nike dropped the endorsement of the shoe line because of his, quote, controversial comments. And the reason why I wanted to mention him, first of all, he's a black man being attacked for standing up for his ideas and beliefs. And it's ironic because I hear black people saying all these other very controversial, and things that are really racist. And because they are in alignment with what the white liberal preaches, then it's okay. But if a black man doesn't do what the typical black man is expected to do by the white fascist liberal, then he is attacked and reviled. But what I wanted to mention in all of this is that there's something wrong. And it's been going on for decades. And that, again, the same thing. We haven't really gone to the fundamentals and looked at what's wrong with our system. But we've had this thing for decades where people are ostracized or lose their jobs or lose their bank accounts because they do something that is contrary to what is popular. So, for example, if you're at a company, you're working, let's say you're a construction worker, you know, you're a bricklayer. I mean, you do something building stuff. So you're not a politician, you're not an intellectual, you know, elite, and you're not a philosopher who's paid to philosophize about things. And you say something controversial on social media, something, let's say that you support Trump, and the company that hired you is run by a white fascist liberal. And they read your post where you say, you know, Trump, go Trump, and then you get fired because the explanation is, oh, he said something, and then they try to tie that Trump comment somehow to some sort of racism, and therefore it's a bad reflection on the company, and therefore we have to let you go because you. Our company does not tolerate intolerance, which is ironic. There's a bit of a paradox, philosophical contradiction there. But the most intolerant people are the people who preach tolerance. That's just a fact of life in the current environment. But the thing is that companies can feel justified in letting and in punishing people who have views that they don't agree with. And I would understand this in it would make sense. For example, if let's say you have a Christian ministry and there's someone out there, a person who works in this Christian ministry or organization that is overtly Christian, promoting Christian ideas and all that. And you have this person who starts posting things that are for some reason, you know, very immoral, very obscene and evil and all these things. And let's say that they robbed a bank. Let's just say it like that. That's some very straightforward thing to avoid all the ambiguous lines that we have been drawing in these last few decades. But let's think of something very simple and straightforward that everyone could agree with. The guy works for a Christian organization and he robs a bank. So he's clearly violating the Christian tenet of thou shalt not steal. And he's caught and he's on the news and the people say he worked for this Christian organization. Then it makes sense for the Christian organization to fire him. Why? Because he's doing something that is completely the opposite of the values that are officially held by this Christian organization because it's dedicated to Christian stuff. Let's say that that is not a controversial or a crime that he committed. Let's say that he praised Islam, and that Islam is another valid religion. And if you're a Christian, then you go in the Christian organization, you can go, hey, you know, we are saying that Christianity is the truth, and you're saying that Islam is the truth, then you can't work for us. You can't be, you know, saying something contradictory to what we are saying. That's why we have to let you go. That makes sense. Or we suspend you for having said this because this is against what we are officially working on. We are a Christian organization working on Christian-related things. You're doing something completely opposite of that. But if you're a construction worker, what is your views on Trump or Joe Bite Me or anyone have to do with you laying bricks? How does your laying of bricks change? How are your bricks of better quality, brick laying of better quality or worse quality because you support Trump or don't support Trump? You see what I'm saying? It's not related. And it's wrong. Like if I'm working in a software company and if I write or say something that is in disagreement with the wokeness of the company I work for, why should I be punished? Why should I be penalized for expressing my opinion if my opinion has nothing to do with the work I was hired for? You know, if you're a painter, a house painter. I mean, if you're a house painter, why should you be fired because you support Trump? Or let's say you're a stupid liberal and you say something very liberal on social media, and you're working for a conservative company. Why should the conservative company fire you because you're an idiot outside of your workplace? It's this, you know, like for example, if you like to party and do all these crazy things at night, but you come to work during the day and do your job, that's all that should matter. And that should be a principle in the Constitution, in the New American Constitution, that protects people's ability to express themselves if what they are expressing themselves in is not directly related to their work. They should not be punished. Like for what has happened before, like with Mike Lindell here in America, person who's very strong Trump supporter and all that, and banks closed his accounts because of his political views. What does his political views have to do with his accounts? There is no connection whatsoever between one thing and the other. Those rights are not being protected because the Constitution does not have anything to say about that. And that has to change. We have to have an environment where the right to life, when it's manifested through free speech, is protected when your expression has nothing to do with your work. This has to be kind of ironed out a bit, hammered out to make it a very concise, generic principle. But the basic idea should be that you should be free to express yourself and not be arbitrarily attacked just because you disagree with you have a personal disagreement with someone else, because that's what it boils down to. There's a personal disagreement between the owners of the Brooklyn Nets and Kyrie Irving, but it's a personal disagreement over social matters that have nothing to do with putting a ball in, you know, through a hoop. What does that what the hell does that have to do with anything else? So even if Kyrie Irving was a crazy nut job liberal, you know, that's his thing. The only thing that should be allowed is the Brooklyn Nets saying, hey, that's his personal view. You know, like the disclaimers that you see sometimes on before a television show. This channel does not, this is a paid endorsement. This channel does not support, necessarily support what you're about to hear in the next program. Same thing, you know, the Brooklyn Nets can say, hey, we, that's his personal comments, and that those are not the comments of the Brooklyn Nets, and leave it at that, because the Brooklyn Nets should not be making social statements about anything. The Brooklyn Nets are a basketball team. That's all they should do. Software companies should not be making social statements about things. And as we've tried to explain before, companies should not be allowed to promote political parties or do donations. Donations should be from individuals. And I would also even be against companies doing donations to charities. And you say, oh, that's not right. No, no. See, the thing is, if the company wants to do charitable work, let them give the money to their employees. And if they want to, they can say optionally, we recommend these charities. We're giving you this raise so that you can donate to charities if you want to, and we recommend these ones. But it should not be forcible, because the company is a collective thing. And it's, if I work for a company that donates to an organization, a quote, charity organization that supports abortion, but I am anti-abortion, then it's as if I am being forced to donate to something that I'm completely against. That's why a company should not be allowed to donate to anything, even if it's a good cause. That should be individuals. Individuals should be the ones doing that. Imposing of views on people in contexts that are not where it's not applicable should stop. If I'm playing basketball, that's the context. And I was hired to play basketball. If I'm doing a good job, then great. If I'm not doing a good job, then great. And it should be unconstitutional to tie in put into the contract, well, you know, we anything that makes us look bad or whatever means that you can be fined or this, that, and the other. It should never be allowed to happen. You should be judged on the merits of your work and your work only, specific to the company. And if you do things on your own, that's your problem, and the company can distance itself from your shenanigans off the court or, you know, off the company, but it shouldn't be have the right to punish you for them. Why should the company, just because you work for them, be able to control what you can or cannot say? Because that's what it basically boils down to. You work for a company, and you have to sell your soul to them, and you have to say, hey, if I work for this company and you give me money so that I can subsist, I will have to avoid saying anything that is not to your liking. That is wrong. That is a violation of my right to life. I'm becoming a slave. And that's what Kyrie Irving is becoming. And all this stuff that Black people are constantly saying, they keep complaining, all these Black millionaires who keep complaining about the NBA being run by whites, and it's like the NBA is like a plantation. And all the white liberals go, yeah, that's exactly what's going on. When that's not the case at all. But the irony is, here's a case where Kyrie Irving is becoming a slave in a plantation, the NBA plantation, that says you have to say and think a certain way, and if you work for us, you will have to submit your soul and your political views to our thinking. That's becoming a slave, and that's what they're trying to do with Kyrie Irving. And the sad thing is, he doesn't really have the persona, the character, the fortitude to really fight back the way he should. And he tries to kind of have it both ways, and it's not going too well. And it should stop. And there should be something in our constitutional system that protects people who don't want to be slaves anymore, who are being forced to sell their souls in order to subsist. It was important to mention that. So now let's just say a few more things about the 15th Amendment. I think we have already said what we wanted to say, and it was related to how the 15th Amendment was circumvented so many times in the late 19th century by these Jim Crow laws because the Constitution didn't have very clear centralized rules on who can vote and how to regulate that. So that just gave opened the door for all these states to then add to the Constitution these subtle layers that effectively disenfranchised black people in the South, and it's the fault of federalism. So, and by the way, I don't know if this was mentioned before, but in the South there was a system of white primaries. So, in other words, maybe the federal election could not be denied to black people, at least officially. But in the primaries, they did deny black people the right to vote. So it was like white-only primaries. So at the end of the day, and it goes again to the whole system, how it's all messed up. We shouldn't have this system of political parties. We've explained this ad nauseum. But under the current system, we have the party, the Democrat parties would have, and they also impose rules in general. But the thing is that at least the Democrats would have these white-only primaries. And that means if you can control the primaries, then you control the candidates who run at the end. So if black people can't vote in the primaries, they can't really affect because the decision has already been made for them. So they have these two candidates that they would have never voted for had they had a chance to vote in the primaries. And so a lot of bad stuff was going on in the South as the country was decaying spiritually because it didn't finish the job. It had to be finished right after the Civil War. And we can blame Lincoln and all these other people for all of that. So Grant took over in 1868, as we said before. He won resoundingly. We try to share a little bit of why he won resoundingly. We also talked a little bit about how he established federal military rule in Georgia. Because Georgia was just running amok with the white racism. They had kicked out all the black legislators from the state legislature. They expelled them. They had been properly elected, but the whites said no, so they kicked them out. And then Grant sent troops and said, no, you're putting them back. And as we explained before, that's what the South should have been, a conquered territory. It should have never been allowed back into the Union until they bowed their knees and said, we repent of everything we've done and we bow in shame over what we've done. I mean, it's ridiculous. The things that we're tolerating, the conservatives tolerate, there should be no, as we've said before, no Jefferson Davis statues anywhere. Jefferson Davis should be like, a statue of him should be like having a statue of Mao Zedong or Stalin or Lenin. He was an evil murderer, worthless son of a bitch, burning in hell as we speak. There should be no tribute to him or to Robert E. Lee, a traitor, a worthless, pathetic little son of a bitch traitor. And why do we have statues like that? Because the South never bent the knee. And why did they not bend the knee? Because we did not force them to bend the knee. But Grant did have that attitude. We're gonna make you bend your knee. And he sent troops into Georgia and restored the black legislators who had been elected. And by mid 1870, we mentioned that the former Confederate states of Virginia, Texas, Mississippi, and Georgia ratified the 15th Amendment, and then were readmitted into the Union. But again, they were readmitted too quickly. And we also mentioned that on June 22nd, 1870, Grant signed the bill that created the Department of Justice, or the Justice Department. And so it's interesting, the Justice Department that has turned so evil now, completely evil, was actually created by a republic, or in a Republican administration, by a Republican who enabled it because it was to be the instrument to attack racism in the South. And the Department of Justice was first, as we said, created to deal with racism, especially with the KKK. And Grant appointed a man called Amos Ackerman as the Attorney General. And Benjamin Bristow was America's first Solicitor General. And he assisted Ackerman in the Department of Justice. And both of them, Ackerman and Bristow, used the resources made available through the Justice Department to vigorously prosecute the Ku Klux Klan in the early 1870s. So they really went after them. And it was with the support of Grant. And Grant also appointed a man called Hiram C. Whitley as the director of the new Secret Service Agency in 1869. So, you know, he was elected. His first year was 1869, and he hit the ground running. So he created the Secret Service Agency in 1869. And, you know, when we think nowadays in America about the Secret Service, we think about the people who protect the so-called president. As we've said, there's no more president. That's just a charade. Bush 43 was the last American president, visible American president. Everyone else since then has been anything but a president. Obaster was an imposter. Trump was a king. And Joe Bite Me is a thief. But there have been no presidents ever since. But the thing is, the Secret Service is supposedly there to protect the president, and I think senators and people like that. But originally, it was created for something else. What happened was that the Klan, the Ku Klux Klan, would operate in a very secretive way. And the solution that Grant and the radical Republicans of his day had was, okay, we're going to fight secret tactics with secret tactics. And that's why they created the Secret Service Agency, to infiltrate the Klan in the South and kind of ferret them out of their secret holes and prosecute them. So Hiram C. Whitley, he successfully arrested 12 Klansmen in Georgia who had murdered a leading local Republican official. So, you know, the Klan were running rampant in the South. This was just right after the Civil War. So that's why I'm saying the South never bent the knee. We had the opportunity to kick them in the groin and punish them and humiliate them and spit on them until they repented. But we didn't do that. And or Grant tried to do that a bit, but unfortunately, it was not enough, and it was just for a short while. And but there were people who were fighting the battle. And this Whitley, as we said, successfully arrested 12 Klansmen in Georgia. And these 12 Klansmen had lynched a Republican, and they were getting away with it. But when Grant took over, you know, things started to change. And this Whitley fellow, hired talented detectives, and these detectives infiltrated and broke up KKK units in North Carolina and Alabama. So they were using, you know, secret tactics to fight the secret organization. And unfortunately, they were not able to penetrate the main hotbed of KKK activity in upstate South Carolina. So at least in upstate South Carolina, South Carolina is a hotbed of evil. And even to this day, and as we've said before, this does not mean that if you're from South Carolina, you're evil personified. It's, you know, I'm not talking about every individual in South Carolina being evil, but in general, there's something very evil about South Carolina. And maybe in a future audio snippet, we'll talk about some of the things that kind of bring out the evil, that kind of show how much evil there is embedded there. It's still there. If you go to South Carolina, there's something in the air. It's like a, you know, like when you people talk about a haunted house and you go in and you feel the presence, that's what's in South Carolina. There's a presence there and it's lingering in the air and people have learned to live with it. People in South Carolina have learned to live with that. And there's a lot of that in North Carolina too. There's a lot in North Carolina, there's a lot of legacy of witchcraft and weird things like that. There's something in the air in those two Carolinas. But South Carolina, North Carolina has some has a lot of problems. But South Carolina has even bigger problems. There's like, I cannot explain it. There's something wrong there. And it breeds a lot of evil. And that's why South Carolina was the state that seceded, that rebelled against the Union and started the Civil War. It's not a coincidence. So the thing is that Whitley was not able to penetrate the hotbed of KKK activity in upstate South Carolina. And Grant did send in army troops there, but Whitley's agents learned that they were that the KKK people had kind of like gone underground and they were waiting for the troops, the Union army troops to leave the area. And Whitley warned Ackerman about this, and Ackerman then convinced Grant to declare martial law and send in U.S. Marshals with federal troops to arrest 500 Klansmen. So that's how many Klansmen they got. And 100 more were able to get away and flee the state of South Carolina. And there were hundreds of others that surrendered, and they did that, you know, in return for leniency. So there was a big crackdown going on of the KKK during Grant years. In the first few years of Grant's first term, 1,000 KKK indictments were given out by the Department of Justice. And out of those 1,000 indictments, there were around 550 convictions. And most of the people convicted only served kind of brief sentences. But the people, the head honchos, the top KKK people were imprisoned, some for up to like 5 years in the federal penitentiary in Albany, New York. So, and I think that was still not enough, but they were doing something. Grant was doing something. To me, he's probably the third greatest president in American history. So to me, the three greatest presidents in American history are Ronald Reagan, George Washington, and Grant, probably in third place. And when I say Ronald Reagan and George Washington, I say it with so much disappointment. You have no idea how disappointing it is to say that those are the two greatest presidents in American history. Ronald Reagan was so flawed. He had so many things wrong with him. But he's probably the greatest president we've ever had. And maybe in a tie, virtual tie with George Washington. George Washington, because of the symbolism, he had so many good qualities. They were good qualities, but at the end of the day, there was nothing after those qualities. I don't know how to explain this. He was not a promoter of ideas, of political or social ideas in a deeper sense. He was an administrator as president, and he was a good man, a good general, a man of character and integrity and all that. But it seems like it didn't propel him to be a creator of new ideas and a proposer of new principles So it's ironic that he's called, many call him the father of our country, when he really didn't have, he was not a person who was laying down new principles and ideas, foundational principles. I mean, at the end of the day, the person who did most of that was James Madison. A lot of bad principles, but at least he was laying down principles. If anyone is really the father of the country, more would be more James Madison than George Washington. But George Washington has a lot of merit because of what he did. Just the symbolism of him not trying to stay as president for life, and he could have if he had wanted to, but he didn't want to be a king. He wanted to have democracy flourish in America. Yes, democracy. I said conservative, not republic. Democracy. And go to hell if you think that's not the right way to say it. Go to hell. And I mean that literally. Go to hell. And I curse you. Every time a conservative starts saying, oh, this is not a republic, this is democracy, you're saying, I am for elitism. That's what the Republican concept is when you distance it from democracy. And go to hell if you feel offended by saying democracy, when I say democracy. But the thing is, Grant was one of the three greatest presidents, and George Washington and Ronald Reagan are one and two. I'm not sure who is one, who is two, but it's sad that that's the best we have. And Grant was could have been better, but he, I think he was weakened by several things that we may talk about a little bit later. But let's continue here. Ackerman's successor, George H. Williams, his successor in the Department of Justice in December of 1871, he continued to prosecute the Klan all the way through 1872, and then even into the spring of 1873 during Grant's second term, because Grant was president. He was elected in 1868, and he was president until 1876 for 8 years. And for six of those 8 years, we had the glory years, you could say, of American politics. So you could say Grant was the president over the greatest period of American political history, 1868 through 1874. And Williams did start doing some sort of a clemency and moratorium on Klan prosecutions, but it was not so much because he was soft on them. It was more because the Justice Department just got inundated by so many cases that they didn't have enough manpower to prosecute everything. I mean, that's how bad it was. But believe you me, by the time Grant was done, the KKK was virtually gone. Well, not gone in the sense of gone, you know, but I mean neutralized, let's put it that way. It was basically neutralized by Grant and the efforts of the Justice Department. And the reason why this is important is that because we really didn't follow up with the justice after what happened in 1874, and we'll get to that, I guess, maybe in the next audio snippet, the Department of Justice stopped doing justice, and no one cared. No one cared. The Democrats obviously didn't care because they wanted injustice. They wanted the opposite of justice. But the sad thing is the Republicans in America stopped caring. It's like, okay, we've done enough for the Negro. It's all, and, you know, and they all started doing the hand-washing thing and out of sight, out of mind. And the Department of Justice stopped doing justice, to stop doing what it was created for. And because of that void began to get filled up. And now we have the Department of Justice working to destroy conservatives. And conservatives go, hey, you know, how unfair is this? Well, it's in a certain kind of twisted way, it's your doing. Because you never cared about the Department of Justice not doing its job, so you left a vacuum. it's actually it had a vacuum of functionality, and you didn't care. And because you didn't care, that vacuum has been filled with the very thing that's now destroying you. You know, we always hear it, that saying about evil prospers when good people say nothing. And that's kind of, in a sense, in a very vague sense, kind of what happened here. And now we the conservative complains about the Department of Justice being used against it. Well, you didn't care when the Department of Justice was not doing its job, so the vacuum was filled. The Secret Service was created not to protect the president. It was created to protect the black man in a kind of a very peculiar way. People don't realize this. The Secret Service was really, in a way, created to protect the black man from the Klan. So you didn't care about using the Secret Service for doing what's right. Then the secret, now secrecy is being used to destroy you. All the secret secrecy that the Democrats have been doing to undermine our election system and destroy the political opposition and all these things, that is the byproduct of conservatives not caring about the Secret Service not doing its job, its real job. So we're getting the payback. As we said, this is kind of in a weird way, twisted way, related to what we said before with the story with Pelosi's husband being attacked by this man who is believed to have had a conspiracy theory ideas. And yes, I've heard, I do believe that a lot of the things that were said about him were just propaganda from the liberals who were just took the opportunity to create websites with fake stories about him. And then they took them down. Like, the websites came up one day, like, after the attack, or 2 days after the attack, and then they were taken down 2 days later. But it was all just this flash flood of propaganda to make this guy look like, this attacker of Pelosi, look like a Trump supporter, radical conservative who believed in conspiracy theories and things like that. But even though that all that is the case, and it doesn't take away from the fact that from what I understand, he really did believe that 9/11 was an inside job, because he was related to, I think, married or a strong friend of people who did believe this. There was this lady, I forget her name, who I think was married to him or was a big friend of his, and I think he lived in her house or something to that effect. And this lady has said, yes, he agrees with a lot of our ideas. And from what I understand, she is a strong 9/11 conspiracy person. So even though this guy's not maybe believing the conspiracies of that a lot of conservatives believe, he does believe in some conspiracies. And it's that same spirit, as we said before, that same thing that infiltrates the conservative mindset, because it's their way of explaining away the fundamental flaws of our system left behind by the founding fathers. And yes, a lot of the quote conspiracy theories have validity in them, like nuggets of truth. But as we've said, try to kind of explain a little bit, they have these nuggets of truth, and that they get distorted and exaggerated, and to kind of explain, yes, we are in trouble because there's this organized effort to destroy us. Yes, there is a lot of organization, but at the end of the day, it is not it's not exactly as the conspiracy lays it out, and so we're fighting. It's just that the conspiracy theory creates an enemy that explain an evil agent that is doing all this evil. And then the conservatives who believe in this start attacking this imaginary agent. And because it's not real, then they're just fighting a phantom, fighting a ghost. It's like throwing punches in the air at a ghost. And then the real people who are doing the harm then can do what they have to do, or the, what they want to do. And the system doesn't change. We are opening all these doors. It's as if, let me put it this way. It's as if people are leaving their windows open, and they're having people break into their house and steal stuff from them. And they keep complaining, our house is being burglarized every night. And then somebody says, you know what's happening? There's a ghost who's coming in at night. He goes through the wall, materializes, takes your stuff, and then somehow takes it through the wall and leaves. So they are all there waiting, and he comes in through this wall. So all the conservatives are standing in front of the wall waiting for the ghost to appear so that they can grab him and catch him in the act and stop him from stealing. And while they're looking at the wall waiting for the ghost to show up, all the real people who are not ghosts are breaking in through the windows that are open and stealing their stuff behind their backs and crawling out. And then there are people who start saying, hey, the problem is not the ghost. He's not coming in through this wall. The problem is all the windows you have open. And then they go, no, there's no windows open. Our founding fathers did not leave any gaps in our system. Oh, no, no. It was fundamentally sound. They were wise men who knew students of the human nature. So they created these system of balances where there's control. No, no, it's some sort of evil, surreptitious ghost that's doing all this. And it's, no, it's real people doing it. And they're going in through the windows, open windows and doors the founding fathers left behind. And no one is going to shut the windows and close the doors. They're waiting for the ghost. The ghost is the explanation that justifies them not dealing with the open windows and doors. Because to deal with those windows and doors means admitting the founding fathers that we idolize were not what we thought they were. And that's just blasphemy to them because they worship them. It's idolatry. Just like a lot of people who are trapped in their racial paradigms don't want to hear someone criticizing their race because they idolize their race. And to admit that this is true, even though it's true, they know it's true, but to admit it in their minds means to profane and dethrone the idol they have in their hearts, and they don't want to do that. So just like liberals are always doing that, and the minorities who support their evil attitudes and value systems because they worship their ethnicity in the same way conservatives worship their traditional values and all these things that are destroying and undermining them. And you can see that even in the Christian conservatives, worshiping a worthless conservative, traditional Christian religious system that is the foundational reason behind all the problems we have. If they had a different mindset, different attitude, things would be different in this country, but they don't want to admit it. They don't want to believe that they're worthless. Traditional Christian system, and I say Christian in quotes, what they call Christian system, is fundamentally flawed and corrupted, and weak and useless. And as long as they want to hold on to their little churches and their little religious systems and their quote Christian values, they will never be of any influence against the forces of evil in this country. Never. They can fight it off a little bit here and there, but eventually they will always be defeated. And that's where our country's headed. Maybe there might be signs of hope. Who knows? There's going to be an election in 3 days from the time of this recording. We'll see how it goes. Let's see how much fraud there is. We'll see how it goes. We have less than 10 months left, I believe, or around 10 months. This is the 5th of November. And we have more or less 10 months left of before the country is officially dead. But maybe there is hope that we will wake up before it's all said and done. Thank you very much for listening.